This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
Welcome to Through the Ringer. I'm your host, Tate Frazier. I am on the road in Durham, North Carolina. And joining us today, we're going to talk some UFC. He is Chuck Mendenhall. Chuck, welcome back to the show, man.
Tate, it's become a tradition, hasn't it? I really like this. Means it's a big event. This is what I like.
Yeah, I feel like at this point you could say UFC might be the fourth biggest sport in the US of A at this point. So it is a big talking point. We always go to you. You are the expert. I am the novice. You will learn as we talk through this if you don't know already. But you get me up to speed, so we appreciate that. Let's start with a guy that everybody's talking about, the 299 UFC 299 title fight, Sean O'Malley versus Marlon Chito Vera. Sean O'Malley -280 in this one. How did Chito win the first matchup? Let's start there, Chuck.
Man, I got to say, like, this is so different. It's such a juxtaposition from that first fight. The first fight happened right at the height of the pandemic. It was in August, I think, of 2020. It was a dead quiet, and I mean cathedral quiet, UFC Apex. You could hear the guys breathing, the compression of their gloves every time they'd exchange. Very, very different than this raucous crowd they're going to do in Miami for UFC 299. But it was a weird fight. I thought that basically when you're talking about Sean O'Malley, I think he's more of a range and kind of rhythm guy. Like, he starts to feel it, and he starts to roll, and then he starts flowing, and then you start to see his offense really look majestic. I thought like he was kind of coming across on that, but he took a leg kick somewhere in that first round, and you could see he couldn't put his pressure on his foot, and it was later diagnosed, I think, is something called drop foot, which kind of like it's a nerve thing that kind of affects your foot, like the front of your foot. So he couldn't put his weight on it. He was a compromised fighter at that point. And you're like, how will he handle this? We'd seen him kind of in situations before where he was kind of hurt and he came through, but not against Chito Vera, man. That was the one fight. Like, he took a shot. He took a couple shots on the feet, and then he ended up on his back. Big elbow to the face. Some follow-up shots there at the very end of the first round. Referee stepped in and buzzkill for the UFC. That was O'Malley's first loss, and I think at that point they were trying to skyrocket him. But Chito Vera had other plans, man. And this whole feud, it stretches now, what, 3-4 years, goes back to that. You know, it all goes back to that. These guys have been battling on social media and everywhere they go, interviews. So it's been a long time coming, lots of fun, bad blood between these guys.
Yeah, and it does feel like O'Malley is becoming like a singular star for the sport, right? People are talking about him so much, and you hear his name mentioned so much, and he is, you know, kind of had this ascension in the bantamweight division. Like, can you just talk about, you know, where he is now and how that kind of all happened? Started with a KO right over Sterling to earn that title.
Well, it's funny because sometimes, you know, some of these guys get hyped up, especially these young guys, when the UFC feels they might have the it factor, you know what they always talk about. Right. It means he's kind of he can translate both in and out of the cage. I think that he was designated that right away. He came through Dana White's Contender Series. People paid attention to him. He had the curly brown hair, tattoo, you know, whatever. It was he was smoking spliffs with Snoop Dogg. You know, he was all over the place. He was handling social media. And his rise has kind of been polarizing, but at the same time, people have paid attention, and he keeps winning. The Chito Vera being the outlier, And even in that one, he kind of, you know, even though Wikipedia and every, and UFC records say that that happened, like, he himself denied that he lost the fight. So this has been an ongoing thing. He's just had that thing, man. And it's crazy because I think there's been a lot of doubt as to if he could really continue to be the guy and if he could actually win at the highest level. The last two fights, he's been at least a minus 250 underdog against Petr Yan, and then his last fight against Aljamain Sterling. Wins them both. He wins the second one going away, where he gets a knockout. So he's one of those guys, I think the escalation of event, the escalation of stakes, his superstardom or whatever you want to call it within the sport, he rises to the occasion. So I think he loves the big stage, and this is a perfect event for him, the setup for this.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we always hear the old adage, right? You know, styles make fights. I mean, can you talk about their styles now? Like, what stands out about O'Malley? I mean, I know he likes to KO guys. That is sort of his calling card. Vera has never been KO'd ever. So we kind of have like two things that, you know, something's got to give right in this fight.
Right. I mean, right away, and again, we've talked about this before. Sometimes on paper, you're like, this looks like an underfight. Even though it's bantamweight, where finishes aren't as numerous, they aren't as common. But these guys thump, like both of them. And I think the bad blood, they're going to come in there and want to put on a show. It's funny because I think we focus so much on the firepower of O'Malley because his fights have been so examined and all that stuff. Chito Vera actually has the most finishes in bantamweight history in UFC. Like, he's got 6 KOs, 4 submissions. The guy can do it everywhere. And I'd say that the big difference here is that Chito's kind of, he's just a nasty pressure fighter. Like, he comes in, and if you fall asleep, if you let your guard down for a minute like Dominic Cruz, you end up getting face kicked, and you're on the mat, you know, and you're gone. You don't even know what hit you. I think that's what makes it fun. You know, and O'Malley is a guy who can counter very well. And let's say that there is a moment where Cheeto's being aggressive. How did he get Sterling? He hit him with a right hand on the counter, drops him, and that's the beginning of the end. So it just it's just an interesting dynamic. I think one guy's going to try to be aggressive and set the tone, and the other guy, I think, is such a sniper in O'Malley that he can put the lights out even as he's falling away.
And we talked about this with, you know, the WWE, kind of like, would there be some characters that kind of come out of UFC? Yeah. Would it be more of a showmanship? It does feel like these guys have a little bit of that persona, right? That character to the way that they fight and to the way that they carry themselves. So that is interesting from the entertainment aspect. So I'll ask you what everybody wants to know, the outcome of the fight. That's what everybody does when they talk about these fights. So who, when, and how do you think this fight plays out between these two guys?
I'll tell you right now that I know the UFC wants O'Malley to win this fight because on the back end of it, and this is the greatest thing the UFC does, is have a dangling carrot of Merab Dvalishvili, who's like, the, you know, won 10 in a row, and he's coming up, and everybody wants to see that fight with him and O'Malley. They have some blood, bad blood, too. So the table is really set for this, for him to go in there and showcase, meaning Sean O'Malley, the Sugar Show. Like, if he's able to go in there and put on the show, avenge himself, you know, avenge that loss, get it back, use the microphone, bring in Merab Dvalishvili. I think that's one of those great moments for the UFC, and it sets the table for a very big fight down the line. I get scared when they have a setup like this because you're always like, UFC so many times gets so close to something like this, some kind of harmony where you're like, oh, everybody's going to go crazy, and then the other guy wins. It won't be the worst in the world if Chito were to win this fight because Ecuador, first champion, all that stuff. But I'm going to go off of what I told you before. I think that O'Malley has risen to the occasion. Just about every time that we've had more stakes, more pressure, all that stuff, and he gets it done. Things slow down for him. He gets it done. I'm going to say that he puts Chito Vera away second round with a KO. I think he becomes the first guy to put away Chito that way. I think that's how it's going to go down. Yep.
So we're going to see some history, right? What's going to happen in Miami. So if you believe in that, you can get O'Malley right at minus 280. So obviously the odds makers believe that he is going to be ended up winning this fight. So that is going to be fascinating. And if it does go the other way, let's say that, you know, Chito does win plus 210, great value there. Do you think O'Malley acknowledges the fact that he lost this fight? I know he wouldn't acknowledge the first fight. What do you acknowledge the second fight?
He's going to have to acknowledge this one, unfortunately, because, you know, one time you could play the fluke game or whatever it is, but you can't. There's no such thing as the two-time fluke. So he'll have to actually acknowledge this one if that happens.
Yeah, fool me twice. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back with Chuck, we're going to talk some more UFC 299.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca.
I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're still here with Chuck Mendenhall, and he is trying to make me smart when it comes to UFC talk, so I appreciate him. He's doing the Lord's work here, and let's talk about this lightweight matchup. We have Dustin Poirier, plus 164, taking on Benoit St. Denis, who is the favorite here at minus 215. The former champ, Dustin Poirier, had a few title matches since he won over Max Holloway. If he wins this fight, could he get another shot? What say you, Chuck?
I think so. It's such a mess, you know, at the top of that division right now at lightweight. But I think that him having kind of his, you know, Dustin Poirier kind of having the cult following and just being the OG that he is, 29 UFC fights, man. He's been in there with against everybody. It's just it's kind of a crazy run that he's on. And to do it now against a guy who I think most people really look at as, watch out for this guy. Watch out. You know, for Benoit St. Denis, because he is just plowing through guys. And if he's eight, so if Dustin Poirier is able to get through him, I would think that would be good enough to get that title shot. If not that, short of that, at least a legacy type fight where he'd make a lot of money, basically in a main event style, like a Nate Diaz. Like, he's always wanted that Nate Diaz fight. Maybe they get that done, bring Nate back in. But I think he could get right there. And from St. Denis' standpoint, I mean, he could be right there too, right? I think that a lot of people, especially the UFC, are very, very much behind him and see the potential of his market being from France and all of that stuff. So I think that that has big marketing potential for the UFC.
Yeah, I mean, talking about marketing potential, Benoit, God of War is the name, the nickname for him. I mean, can you explain the background on this? I mean, it feels like he is now coming to the forefront and we're all going to figure it out, but I need you to break that down. That's
all I
name.
Know is that it's the perfect nickname. Now, I don't know, I know that you don't get a chance to watch all these fights, but at UFC 295, this is the perfect example of just who this guy is. UFC 295 was held at Madison Square Garden. There's this guy, Matt Frivola, who was his previous opponent. He grew up in the New York area, trains in the New York area. He's like, I want a homecoming. I want to fight at Madison Square. This is my dream. He gets the chance to fight at Madison Square Garden, but they book him against Benoit St. Denis. The dude has this completely cold-blooded, brutal aura. Like, he just comes in there and you're getting nervous just looking at him. But I went back and I looked at this. They kind of have an even fight for about a minute, and then it goes to the ground. This Frivola, being a very good wrestler, dumps St. Denis to the ground. This is at the 3:47 mark of the first round. By the 3:32 mark of that same round, he was knocked out. Head kick.
Oh, my God.
St. Denis had got up as if it was nothing. It just plowed right. It just got up, pushed him against the fence, got into a clinch, hit him a couple times, and on the break, just sent a head kick and just put him down. It was like watching a video game, you know, like where like there's all kinds of excessive kicks and all this. It was one of the most ridiculous sequences I've seen. And I think if you really want to get hyped up for what he's able to do and how strong he is, and how cold-blooded he is, go watch that Frivola fight. So, in my mind, this is a tough, tough test for Dustin Poirier.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he only wins by KOs, right? That's kind of like, you know, his calling card is knockouts. And then his sole loss was a decision in 2021. So, is this the time that he, if he does win this fight, we push him and everybody now knows who he is? You know,
I think it's strategic, right? I think it's strategic by the UFC. And you see these guys sometimes. You see sometimes where a guy barely can get a top 15 fight, and even when he does, he'll hover in that top 15 space. They're not trying to expedite him. With Brock St. Denis, he was actually going into that situation against Frivola as an unranked fighter within the lightweight division. I think Frivola at the time was 14. Destroys Frivola, right? So now he's somewhere, I think, maybe 12. This is where St. Denis, and Dustin Poirier, being kind of the old guard, is sitting at 3. So if he's able to go in there and beat Dustin Poirier, who's just a staple of that top five and faced everybody, like I said, has wins against so many of the guys in that top space, he catapults right past so many of these guys. And I think that we just saw Ilya Topuria from Spain beat and take Volkanovski's belt. And, you know, Spain celebrated him. He was on Marca magazine. Like, he was, they celebrated him like he was a global icon. Like, he was their own, and it was just the same. I think that's what they want from France, and I think that they've got a good opportunity to do that with a guy like Brock Santini. So the UFC is 100% expediting him and putting him into positions to succeed. And also, they kind of know, and I don't mean to, like, discount Dustin Poirier, but they kind of know when a guy hits a certain age. And remember, this is Dustin Poirier has been around. He's in his 30s, mid-30s. He's 29 fights. He's 13 years in the game, fought everybody, just got head kicked KO'd in his last time out. It's got that feeling. It's got that feeling of the changing of the guard, and because the guy who's coming is the blood-dimmed tide. I really believe that Brock St. Denis goes in there and puts on that showcase that makes him into kind of a star in the UFC.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, we got the NBA, we got Wembanyama, right? The Frenchman that we're bringing over, and we're pushing him to the forefront. You talk about a changing of the guard. Maybe that happens with another Frenchman, but in the UFC. So that is something to keep an eye on. I mean, outcome of the fight, I mean, who, when, and how? The simple questions, Chuck. It sounds like God of War is going to send a message to everybody you know, across the country.
People keep trying to talk me out of this. Because they believe in Dustin Poirier, and I understand it, man. Dustin Poirier has been around, and he's been in a lot of wars, and he is a dog. I wrote a piece in The Ringer. I think he's one of those guys that has more dog in him than just about anybody else that you could name in the UFC. He's just that guy. Mm-hmm. But I see this too often. It's like where the guy who is a 35-year-old guy goes against the 28-year-old up-and-comer who's just slaughtering everybody, and that's that moment of reality that happens. I feel like that's what's going to happen. So I'm going to say that it's going to be St. Denis and early. So it'd be more like an under and a KO, like somewhere in that range. I think that those bets, I could see these things happening. I think that that's I think that's how it's going to go down, because this guy carries so much immense power and he knows how to unleash it.
Yeah, and then the more that you talk, I feel like this line is going to continue to move, you know, down to like minus 300, minus 350, you know what I mean?
I think it will too. The sharp money will move it. You're right.
Right, right. So another matchup, welterweight matchup. We got Kevin Holland, minus 138, taking on Michael Page at plus 108. Who do you like here? When does it happen, and how does it happen in this fight?
This one's fun because you get a guy like Michael Venom Page, who's coming over from Bellator. He's 36 years old, but he's a guy who Bellator promotion, which was just bought up by PFL and is kind of existing under that umbrella now, is kind of the rival of the UFC, but one of their faces, one of the guys who's kind of a star within their show, has always been Michael Venom Page. People have wanted to see him fight. It hasn't happened. Now it's finally happening, and I think they've given him the perfect opponent. Kevin Holland is a guy who doesn't like to wrestle. In fact, is probably allergic to wrestling. I don't think he would, you know what I mean? Like, he's been beat a couple times where guys just wrestle him to the ground and hold him there. This isn't a guy who'll do that. In fact, I think both guys will accommodate the other in putting on a pretty spectacular striking demonstration. Michael Venom Page was a guy, a karate guy. Like, he grew up, you know, doing tournaments. And if you look at some of those knockouts he had in Bellator, one of the most vicious things, and it probably is the most vicious knockout I've ever seen, was his Evangelista Santos knockout in 2016. He left a dent in the guy's forehead.
Oh, like, yeah, I've seen that.
Flying knee, leaves a dent. The x-rays are just like, you're like, oh my God, how did that happen? I've just never seen anything like that. I'm not squeamish if you watch this game long enough, but that one made me squeamish. So he's got that kind of explosiveness, and Kevin Holland also has a very, very good striking game. So I think that they're going to stand and bang. They're going to do some crazy things. There's going to be some talking in there. I think you're going to see some showmanship like Anderson Silva used to do. I think you're going to see all of that. I'm picking in the end Kevin Holland. I think he spoils this. I think he's going to spoil this homecoming. But I do think we'd probably get another finish. I think it'll be a knockout because I think that these guys will go at it that way. I don't think they're going to try to grind and outpoint each other. I don't think that's why Michael Page is in the UFC.
Yeah, anytime you bring up karate, you know, you have everyone's full attention. Everyone loves talking about karate, so that's always good. Any other fights that we have on the card that you love or that you see an edge on, maybe for people to bet on, just a fight that's hot right now?
I've got two, and I think they're both – and maybe you can tell me the lines if you got them there in front of you. Peter Yan, he's opening the main card against this young kid, Song Yadong, who's out of Team Alpha Male, and he's only 26 years old. Peter Yan, people are sort of sleeping on him now because he's lost three fights in a row. But if you look at those losses, I made a joke once that he's now 0-2 in his last two victories because they were both split decisions that I thought he won. He has lost nothing. I think that he is a guy, and he was a champion, and I think he's one of those guys who is poised to make a run. It might be quiet at first, but I think this is a perfect first step for him. So whatever line they've got on him, it's a good value. I don't know what it is, but I think that he gets it done. And my other one is on the prelims, and this is crazy. This shows you how deep this card is. There's a guy named Matusz Gamrot, who is from Poland, a younger guy. Not younger, he's like in his mid-30s, but he's youngish in the UFC, has some of the best wins in the lightweight division, and people are kind of sleeping on him because he's had a misstep here or there. He's going against an old veteran named Rafael Dos Anjos, and I think this is another one of those changing the guard type fights. I don't really love RDA's chances in this. I think that Gamrot is just that good. I've said on multiple platforms, I still think he'll be a champion someday. So I'm picking Gamrot. I think that to me, that's the Gamrot and the Petr Yan, I would say those are kind of my locks for this fight card.
Yeah, Gamrot is -480, so there's a lot of people.
Maybe you want to take an actual finish or something. Although RDA is tough in that situation, but I think that Gamrot is just that good. Like, I think he'll get it done inside the distance.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're here with Chuck Mendenhall. In case you missed it, we're talking UFC, and now we're talking UFC 300. And looking at this card, this main card, how do you feel about this main card, Chuck? Do you feel good about this? Do you think this is a big draw? Like, what is your takeaway when you see this main card?
So it's complicated, Tate, because this is one of those situations where if this card is any other pay-per-view at any other time, except for the one in the benchmark 100, 200, or 300, people would be salivating about this fight. On this card, from top to bottom, not just the main card, there are 11 either current or former champions. For them to put that kind of card together means you're making all cards around it suffer. That's what's so crazy about UFC 299 preceding it, because it's also stacked. So the big conversation has been, which one's better? I think it's there. As long as they stay intact, both of these cards are really, really good. The one thing I will say, though, and I think this is why people are disappointing. There was supposed to be this groundbreaking, ace up the sleeve main event, right? They drugged this out for a long time. Dana White had teased that it was going to, drop all of our jaws, all that stuff. So when they finally did announce the main event, which was Alex Pereira versus Jamal Hill, and that's a fine fight, any other card. But as the main event for this one, I think there was not a collective groan, but a little bit of like a, oh man, that's what we get, that sort of thing. But on whole, that card is fantastic. All five of the fights on the main card, very good. So I would, as deep as UFC 299 is, UFC 300 is even deeper.
Was there a fight that, when they were teasing that out, that you thought that would be that fight? You know what I mean? Was there one that you had in your mind that you pictured?
Well, there's always this wild, because in the past, the first one, UFC 100, they had Brock Lesnar against Frank Mir. That made sense, right? They had GSP on that card. They had others. The second one, Brock was kind of brought back in out of nowhere to fight in that one, and that was kind of like a big deal. So you're like, okay, there's not going to be Brock Lesnar, but what would be Brock like? What are they going to bring in? I think a lot of people spent time entertaining Khabib Nurmagomedov. Would he be coming back out of retirement with GSP? I mean, they were all kind of far-fetched. I never really believed those. But I thought they had a couple that were pretty good that would actually fit the awe factor that they were looking for. One of them being Israel Adesanya versus Dricus du Plessis, because these guys with both African South Africa versus Africa in general, and it's like you put these two guys together, they have bad blood. I thought they were going to do that. They've already had so many face-offs and everything. They hate each other. I thought they'd go that direction, but they couldn't get that one done. The other one that I thought that they may try to do is Khamzat Chimaev, who you probably know. Like, this is a guy who has been very mysterious, has visa problems getting into the country, but he's also just another guy who, like Islam Makhachev, who just destroys everything. Anybody you throw in there. Yeah. So I thought they may give him a fight against Leon Edwards, the current champion, and see what happens there. None of these materialized, but I thought it'd be something along those lines that would be a little bit out of the ordinary, a little bit something like that. But that's not how it worked. Alex Pereira is an awesome fighter. I love him. He lives right here in my town in Connecticut. But I'm not sure that it moves the needle quite like one of those fights would have.
Yeah, I think those are good calls there. The next big conversation, Francis Ngannou taking on Anthony Joshua. Ngannou dropped Tyson Fury in their 2023 boxing match. So what do you expect, in the second boxing match, the second go-around here for Francis Ngannou?
You know, it's crazy because going into the first one, when he was fighting Tyson Fury, you're like, this is absurd. This is absurd. Mm-hmm. This guy, how does it even get sanctioned? You got a guy with like 33, 34 fights against a guy who has no pro fights in the boxing ring. I think there was a lot of people that's like, this is just ridiculous. This is going to like be a black eye on boxing, all those things. What Francis Ngannou did was not only bet on himself by getting the bag that they were talking about and getting that fight against Fury, but he went in there and knocks him down in the third round, and I think some people thought he won the fight. Mm-hmm. Since then, you know how the fight game works. It's just like everything. People start to say, like, yeah, was Fury taking it easy on him, or was Fury, like, was he just not prepared? There wasn't a lot of tape, right, on Francis Ngannou, all that sort of thing. You should have more confidence in Francis Ngannou going into a second fight against Anthony Joshua, who's also like an Olympic gold medalist and the pride of England, and he's faced a who's who as well. You should have confidence that this is going to be a good fight. I kind of don't, though, because I think there is tape now to look at, and I think whatever propensities you were watching with Francis Ngannou, Joshua has been looking at. Not to mention, this fight is the gateway to get that Fury, whether it's a rematch with Ngannou and Tyson Fury, or if it's Usyk, or whatever that's going to be. But the next big fight, right, these guys have to go through each other. I know Joshua is not taking this lightly, and so I'd be surprised. I really would if Ngannou's able to make a competitive fight out of this one. As much as I want my MMA guy to stand up for all of MMA world and do this, I feel like this would be that moment where reality sinks back in.
Yeah, I mean, Joshua right now -410, so the odds makers, they agree with you there. They see an obvious favorite, but you can get Ngannou at +300. So if you're someone that believes
good value
that it
in
could
the
work
sense
this time,
like, yeah, you're carrying that kind of power in your hand. We saw him, and we've seen it in MMA too. Like if he lands, you're going down. I mean, it's as simple as that. So at +300, I think if you're just looking to gamble and you're just want to, like, I think he can land that shot, that's not a bad bet. I'm not sure he's going to be able to get that done. That's all.
Yeah, I think it would be a bold bet. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say it's bad. I'd say it's bold. Yeah. One last thing, Chuck, before I let you go. This is a little bit off the beaten path. Talking about boxing, Jake Paul, when you talk about fighting, he's a big topic of conversation. Apparently, he's going to fight Mike Tyson on Netflix. Did you see this news, and what was your first reaction when you saw it?
I did see the news, and it's funny because I saw it trickle across like Twitter. I think it might have been my guy, Ariel Helwani. Somebody had put it out there. And at first, I was like, that can't be real, because obviously 57-year-old Mike Tyson, I know that he still flirts around. He wants to be the game. He's always putting out videos. Sometimes he's walking with a cane. Sometimes he's hitting a speed bag. You just don't know what you're going to get with him.
Right.
But I know he has such an affinity for the game. Maybe he looks at Jake Paul and says, I could beat this guy. But it's just the most bizarre thing. I think the bigger story, other than the sort of circus element of this fight, is that it's on the Netflix is getting involved in the fight game. I think that is actually the bigger story. I don't know how they'll proceed. Like, I don't know if it's going to be a bunch of this sort of thing, or if this is just their opening salvo before they like really get involved. But that's the big story. I don't know how much interest I have. It's a weird one, like, because the Jake Paul fights have all been circuses, but they've all been against younger, except for Anderson Silva, who was a little bit up there, but in the 40s, right? Like, this one feels different. This feels a little bit like a young guy fighting even a legend, but geriatric, you know, and I'm like, that's not, I don't know what the appeal of that will end up being. But Dallas Cowboys Stadium.
Yeah,
how crazy is that?
I was going to say, they have the big stage, and at the end of the day, Mike Tyson is a boxer, and you know, a lot of these guys he's been matching up with, they're not technically boxers. You know what I mean? They're in a different
field. You're into it. You like it.
I just like that Mike Tyson's like, I'll show you how to box,
dude. If that happens,
and everybody's
if that happens, it'll be an epic event. If that happens, man, that would be epic. I kind of hope so. I mean, that's one of the things about Jake Paul. The rooting interest is usually who's going to humble the dude, you know, and that would be absolutely stunning if it was Mike Tyson.
Yeah, and that would be, I think, a nice moment for all of us if Mike Tyson was the one to do it. You know what I mean?
Like, so, you finally killed a gnat that's been buzzing in your ear. You're like, he's out of here.
I think it could be fun. So I think that's a good one. Chuck Mendenhall, you're the best. Thanks so much for coming to the show. Where can we find all your work? And we'll let you go enjoy your Friday.
Well, I do some rankings for The Ringer, so those will be coming out, I think, on Tuesday next week, and I do other stuff for The Ringer, and we do The Ringer MMA show right after the pay-per-view and every Tuesday or Thursday before the big cards.
Chuck, you're the best. Thanks so much for coming to the show. We'll have you back again, and I appreciate you getting me up to speed on UFC, man.
You got it, man. Always fun. Take care.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. Joining us now, he is a regular at this point on Through the Ringer. It is the Ringer's very own Brian Curtis. Brian, great to see you.
Heck yes, I'm a regular. Happy to be here, Tate.
You're welcome anytime. We always need your services. We need you to set us straight, to let us know what's actually happening in this insane media landscape that we live in today. And there are a lot of storylines. There are a lot of headlines. You break them down better than anybody on the press box. And I want to talk about a headline that was on TheRinger.com. Shout out to Mirren Fader. This is the headline, The Wait and the Wait for Bonnie James. Obviously, weight spelled differently, a little play on words there, but there's a lot of conversation about Bronny James, and Mirren does a great job explaining all the pressures that are on him. How much have you taken into the Bronny news cycle, and kind of what are your thoughts on all the coverage of Bronny so far in his first year?
It's interesting. I mean, it's in the way it's expected. I think his dad was part of this news story, right? His dad all the time was saying, I want to play with him in the NBA. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, let my son develop at his own pace, let my son stay out of the limelight. It was, you know, I can't wait till my son is standing next to me on the court. So I think that's part of it. It's also just goes to this really natural affinity we have for second generation and third generations in sports. We really do. And you know, you and I have seen this in politics. We've seen this in announcing booths. We've seen this everywhere. But for whatever reason, in sports, it seems to hit us in a particular way.
Mm. I mean, we see it. Steph Curry, Dell Curry, Klay Thompson, Michael Thompson, right? I mean, right now in the sport, in the game, I mean, look at USC's roster. You got Dennis Rodman's kid. You got LeBron James's kid, right? I mean, you got a kid named Kobe. I mean, there's just like, we love when we get the nostalgia plays. And when we have that, we obviously then we put on expectations for these guys. How hard is it for someone that is a freshman playing at USC like Bronny is to deal with the fact that there is the expectation that you're supposed to be one of the next greatest players in all of basketball if that's not actually who you are?
No, you just got to live up to LeBron James, you know. It's not no pressure or anything.
No pressure.
No offense to Dell Curry, but it's a little easier to live up to Dell Curry than it is to LeBron James. No, it's funny, and you mentioned the word nostalgia, but I think it's exactly right, because sports is great for so many ways, but the one bad thing about sports is everything disappears so quickly. You know, we're in the middle of the Chiefs dynasty, and it will be over before we know it, and it'll recede into the past. And I think one of the reasons we like second generation, third generation players so much is because it drags us back into the past and these happy times in our lives. You know, whether it's Bronny James, whether it's Arch Manning, we're like, oh yeah, the Manning Bowl. I remember that. That was a fun time. I remember I was younger then. I was more handsome then. I was a happy time in my life. And I think that what it does is it sort of stops time a little bit for us, and that's a happy feeling.
I mean, even the guy calling the game, Joe Buck, is a second generation star. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much of that around us. And even with actors, right, you find out it's someone, you know, we just saw it with Dakota Johnson, you know, and people are like, oh, my God, that's Don Johnson's daughter. Right. You know what I mean? And then they all of a sudden have a different kind of interest because of that. So it always plays a factor. We talked about Bronny. Now let's talk about the other second generation star that's getting the headlines near and dear to your heart. Arch Manning down there at Austin, Texas. There were some conversations this week about how he decided not to be a part of the new NCAA football game. He was asked about his NIL. He said his dad handles his NIL. He doesn't even know how much NIL money he has, but he knows it's not more than Brock Purdy, which is what some people have reported. The Arch Manning circus, he hasn't even played a game yet, or at least as a starter. Brian, where are we at with Arch right now?
And it was fantastic because even last year as a third string quarterback, he got in a game at Texas in Austin and had to quiet the crowd with his hands before the first snap at a home Amazing. Game because yeah. everybody was so excited to see him. I kind of believe that he might not know how much money he's getting.
I agree, yeah.
And Betty knows it's a lot. I also think that whole environment around him is very controlled. Whenever I read the Texas media about him, there's always a lot of off the record. Oh, no, he's not in the video game because he's focusing on football. No citation who said that, but we could probably guess it's members of his family, if not his dad, who's, you know, everything is handled in a way. And I don't mean that in the sense that it's manufactured or that it's in some conveyor belt. It just feels all very locked down, feels very calm around him. And probably if there's an upside to being that second, or in his case, third generation athlete, it's that there are people involved that are like, we know the drill here. We know what to do. We know how this is going to go.
Yeah, we have the perfect people to kind of rely on. Obviously, you know, throughout the entire Manning family, they have a lot of people that know how it goes and understand those high-pressure situations, especially Texas now going to the SEC where Peyton and Eli obviously played. So it's going to be a new facet of the Manning family and a new face for the Manning family and Arch Manning. But I actually thought this was a pretty cool story. And I feel like you can spin it in a way where it's like Arch doesn't want all the distractions. He just wants to worry about football. And, you know, as much as we love nostalgia, we love eating up the guys who are just gamers, right? When you hear that kind of talk, people are like, oh man, I love this guy, he's just a gamer, he just loves playing the game. So Arch Manning, you're playing the game properly. Let's talk about the narratives, because that is always a fun game, especially coming out of the NFL combine. There was a lot of conversation about Caleb Williams. So I ask a simple question, Brian: who won the NFL combine for you? Was it a player? Was it a team? Was it a player personnel guy? Who was the big winner of the NFL combine?
Well, my man, Xavier Worthy, wide receiver from Texas, 4.2140, which matched my personal record tape when I was a senior down in Austin. I was
right.
I'm happy to see Zay
I've
tie
seen
it.
The footage. It's not like the Wilt Chamberlain game.
No, it's not even like Rich Eisen. Yeah. I mean, I'm just roaring down that field. You know, I think I could perversely argue that Caleb Williams won the combine and Marvin Harrison Jr. too, by going to the combine and being like, we're kind of opting out of this whole thing. Not just working out like a lot of prospects have done in the past, but the medicals too, saying, look, you know, there's not 32 teams who are going to draft me, so why do I have everybody looking at my medical information? And, you know, I think, Ben Solak wrote about this on The Ringer, and I thought he made a really good point, which is this is the future, right? This is part of the player empowerment era. We've seen, you know, players change the system, push on the system in ways that are new. And their way in the system is like, there's just nothing in this for me, and I'm not going to be part of your combine television show. In the case of Caleb Williams, he did do an interview and got a crazy question right off the bat that was like, you know, why are you scared to be here? Why are you scared to not put yourself up against, you know, all these other great quarterbacks? Mm-hmm. But I think in a way that's what counts as winning now.
I thought that Caleb Williams started a new trend at the combine, which is you already know that you're going to get backfire on one of your answers, so therefore you give both answers, so therefore you are right. And the question was, who is your GOAT? Who is the person that you want to be as a quarterback? Which is the classic question when you ask a future number one pick. It's sure. Like, who do you look up to? Who you want to be? He said Tom Brady is who you aspire to, you know, resume-wise, career-wise, you know, the winning mentality, all that sort of stuff. But then he basically said, aesthetically, I want to be Aaron Rodgers. And then later he was asked again. He doubled down. He said Aaron Rodgers. And then before the interviewer could pick up with the next question, he said, but Tom Brady also. You know what I mean? And I don't think I've ever seen someone be able to hedge so much with an answer. I thought it was the future. We talk about what it looks like in the future. It's like guys already know how the news cycle works, so they're trying to get ahead of it before it even happens.
And this is the guy who everybody compares to Patrick Mahomes. So yeah, actually, that was kind of his second and third answer to the question, not even 1-2.
Right. I found it fascinating. So, Caleb Williams, shout out to you for making that happen. Let's talk about free agency. There is another big name, Russell Wilson. I mean, a huge name and a huge cap hit, to say the least, a historic cap hit. Do we think that there is a future for Russell Wilson? He told Brandon Marshall he expects 2 Super Bowls in the next 5 years. Brandon Marshall had a very, I don't even know what face he made. He just basically like, what just happened? Like, someone just smacked me in the face. Do we think Russell Wilson will be a starter in the NFL next year?
I feel like you and I are auditioning for the hype video that comes out when Russell Wilson does make the Super
Bowl. I know.
In a couple years, we're going to be the real of the doubters and the haters and say it.
Yes.
I don't see it, though. I really don't. I mean, I was looking around before we came on today, and I'm like, where would he start? Because it just feels like you're taking on a lot. You know, not only are you saying Russell Wilson still has something left in him, but you're also saying we're kind of building this franchise around Russell Wilson in a way that I don't think a lot of teams are going to be eager to. I mean, he feels like he's gone from Super Bowl champion, nearly 2-time Super Bowl champion, easy Hall of Famer to Jacoby Brissett in record time. And I think that's kind of the model for Russell Wilson going forward. I saw him even tied to the Colts in one article that I read. You know, veteran guy. Maybe he starts games next year, but I don't see him as a week 1 starter.
Yeah, I think people, I mean, myself included, you know, thought maybe the Falcons would take a swing on, you know, just seeing what it looks like, get a temperature check on Russell Wilson. We haven't really heard of rumblings of that actually happening. The Steelers were a team that were thrown out there. But, I mean, the Colts, maybe they want a bridge quarterback before they can get to Anthony Richardson era. You know what I mean? But it feels like that would be strange, you know, after you drafted him and he did show some positive signs. So, very confusing. One last thing, Brian, before we go to break here. Baker Mayfield, do we think he's going back to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? Because there's a lot of conversation of, did he earn this job? Should he be back? You know, the locker room won him over, and he is a former number 1 overall pick. So there is that storyline as well.
I would think so. It just feels like they're trying to get to a number, and we've heard the range is, you know, Baker wants 40-something million, and the Bucks want 20-something million based on one good year of football, right?
Uh-huh.
So there was you know, some reports this week that they were slowly making progress, but I think if it gets closer to the Bucks number, yeah, absolutely, they want him back.
Yeah, Baker, go back to Tampa Bay. Go back to where it works. You know what I mean?
It's
in Tampa Bay,
deal.
Make it happen. Yeah, it's a good deal. It's the NFC South. Anything is possible. Anybody can win the NFC South. I know that because I watch it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about the Academy Awards, and Brian's going to make some picks. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're here with the Press Box's very own Brian Curtis. And Brian, we talked about all the sports stuff. We talked about the narratives. Now let's talk about the real stories. Let's talk about the movies. And we got Oscars odds in front of us. And we're going to run through the biggest awards of this weekend. First and foremost, are you excited for the Oscars? Is this something that you, is this appointment television for Brian Curtis?
From narratives to narrative features, I am absolutely excited about the Oscars. That just feels like there's a very vanishingly small number of things that we all sit down and watch together as a nation. Almost all of them are professional football games now. So it's nice when we can get an Oscars award show or a political debate in there, just so that the top 100 is not entirely NFL. There's like 3 or 4. But yeah, no, I always look forward to the Oscars.
Yeah, and we've had some great drama, right? I mean, we had the La La Land, you know, Moonlight moment. You know, that was insane, to say the least. We had the Will Smith slap of Chris Rock. I mean, The Oscars has been a saga, to say the least. We also had Shape of Water win Best Picture, which I still have not gotten over. But that's my own gripe and my own problems. You know what I mean? So we don't need to get into the
Best Pictures lately. I looked back, I was like, that happened. Wow. Was that the year that was that the COVID year? Like, what was going on with that?
I don't know. That's when my brain was broken. But you know, let's get to the odds here. Let's get to Best Picture this year, because there is a heavy favorite, and it's Christopher Nolan's film Oppenheimer -3,500, Poor Things with +1,800, The Zone of Interest +1,900, Holdovers +2,300, Barbie +4,100, and Anatomy of a Fall, which pretty shocking, the worst odds here, +4,500. Brian, do we think it's Oppenheimer's year and Christopher Nolan's year to win Best Picture?
I think it's absolutely Oppenheimer. This feels like one of the easier ones we've had. You know, I don't know if it's quite Titanic easy, but it feels like overwhelmingly we know where this is going to go. It's the big movie. It's the movie everybody saw. It was a box office hit. It's also the historic resonance. You know, I grew up in an age of big, handsomely mounted historical movies about the 20th century. Mm-hmm. This is one of them. Oppenheimer, absolutely, and Christopher Nolan, too.
Yeah, I love it. I'm happy that Chris, it seems like there was a moment where Christopher Nolan almost had like this, you know, rivalry with the Academy, where it was like they don't want to give him his credit. Leo had this, obviously, as well before he went and did The Revenant. But it feels like this is the year where he gets over the hump. All right. Next, we'll do Best Actor. Cillian Murphy, the star of Oppenheimer, -1,600. Paul Giamatti of The Holdovers, +650. And then nobody else is even close. Bradley Cooper, God bless him. He did a heck of a job on the campaign trail, but he's still behind. +2,300. Coleman Domingo from Rustin +6,500. Jeffrey Wright of American Fiction. American Fiction was, I really enjoyed that movie, +6,500. Cillian Murphy, do we think this is going to happen, or does Giamatti have a chance in The Holdovers?
Giamatti, soft spot in my heart for him, but it's Cillian Murphy, because every talk show host in America, you can feel it. You know, you can feel him concentrating. Mm-hmm. You and I do this when we have podcasts and we want to make sure we pronounce a name correctly.
Oh, man.
And
that's
we
tough.
Hit it hard. How many chat shows have you seen people saying Cillian Murphy, Cillian Murphy?
Yes.
I learned that. I'm ready to go.
It's like they're about to say Killers of the Flower Moon, but they end up saying Cillian Murphy. You know what I mean? It's the same.
Maybe that'll be another La La Land, you know, style mishap there.
That could be. That's a good. I like that. That's a good call. Let's look at Best Actress. Lily Gladstone, Killers of the Flower Moon. She's the favorite, -210. Emma Stone from Poor Things, +140. And then from there, I mean, the odds aren't even close. It's basically a two-person race. Lily Gladstone. Emma Stone, by the way, said that she wants Lily Gladstone to win. It is a good category if you are a Stone, because you got Gladstone and Emma Stone. But what say you, Brian Curtis? Who's going to win this one?
This is the closest major award category. Mm-hmm. Emma Stone's won one before for La La Land, but she does have the Academy favorite, Hollywood favorite, challenging movie, you know, brave movie, I think we would categorize that under. But I still feel Lily Gladstone's a winner here.
Yeah, I think so too. I just feel like for the performance, for what she was asked to do, the fact that she really carries the film. I mean, you know, without Lily Gladstone's performance, I don't think it hits the way that it really would otherwise. So I think that's a good pick. -210. She's the favorite there. Last one, Best Director, Christopher Nolan, heavy favorite, -4,000. Is this the year that Christopher Nolan ends up being the Best Director and wins his Academy Award?
And this was the category right where Greta Gerwig getting snubbed was kind of the biggest, right? You know, not only the biggest news story, but kind of the biggest mystery of what happened. Yeah, I think it does. It just feels like Nolan's year, man. This feels like an Oppenheimer kind of year. It feels like weirdly paired with Barbie. I think now we need the odds of what they say in the acceptance speeches. You know, mm-hmm. Do we get anything that's a little off road? Right. We're going to thank the families. We're going to thank the agents. We're going to thank this film studio. But are we going to get any other references in there? Can we get some odds about what things might be brought up? I think that's kind of fascinating at this point.
I do too, and I also think like Jonathan Glazer, if you haven't seen Zone of Interest, it's a movie that I think you should see. I think the odds of him at +2,600 is rather enticing, because I do think that movie has a chance to maybe shock some people with some of the things that they win. Again, feel bad for Bradley Cooper. I mean, he did a lot of work during this run, but it did not work out in his favor when it comes to not everybody can be nominated, not everybody can win win. So we learned this in sports, you know what I mean? So
we can carry it over. And this is another handsomely mounted historical movie. Again, these are the kind, he made an Oscar movie, right? Like that's I think when it really hits hardest. When you're like, I made an Oscar movie. I played by the rules. I got deep into character, directed it myself, and then it doesn't come true.
Yeah, and he's like, what else do you want from me? Like, I got all of this music approved. I mean, he did a lot of work. He kind of did all, you know, checked all the boxes. And maybe one day Bradley Cooper will get his. Like, I mean, that's kind of part of the Academy's allure, right? It's like trying to get their respect. It's like this long running game that goes on with these actors and creators. So he could be next on the board.
I think to myself, too, all the time. When will Bradley Cooper get a break?
That's what we all say to ourselves. One last question for you, Brian, then we'll let you go. What's the best sports movie of all time? In your opinion, I don't think the general opinion matters here. Just in your opinion, what's your favorite sports movie or the best sports movie, I should say?
So I was thinking about this, and I have two criteria for me. One is it's movies I saw when I was young, because I think that's when the sports movie is its most powerful for you, when you just buy into the power and the belief of sports. And second, a movie I saw in the theater when it came out. So my top three in reverse order would be A League of Their Own, number three. Hoosiers, number two. I remember just losing my mind when a friend's mom took me and my friend to go see that movie. I didn't even know what it was about. I was like, what's a Hoosier? Didn't know the mascot. I was like, this is unbelievable. That's number two for me. But Field of Dreams is absolutely my number one. And I'm not that kind of guy, Tate. You know that, man. I'm not one of those, you know, let's talk about my dad. Let's wipe away a few tears. You know, let's have a catch, as they say at the end of that movie. But every time I watch that movie, I'm like, this is perfect. I love this movie.
I watch Field of Dreams with my dad. I feel like somehow every like 2 to 3 years, like randomly when I'm home, and it always hits. I think that's a great pick. I mean, Remember the Titans I saw in theaters, not to say that's the best sports movie ever, but I mean, it just moved me. And I was a kid when I saw it. So I was like, oh man, this is cinema. 10-year-old me. There's some great sports movies out there that we could run through. I mean, Blue Chips is one of my, you know, there's a lot of those kind of movies too that are fun, but Hoosiers is now, I think, become severely underrated in these times. Like, people don't even give it the credit that it's due, because it is such a great movie.
And there's a remake of Hoosiers coming out, is that right? We're doing a remake?
Apparently.
I don't know.
I think we need it.
I don't know if we need to remake any of these. I really don't. Field of Dreams, man. But that's just like, to me, it's like, it's baseball season. I remember watching it one time. My wife had never seen it. We put in the DVD or streamed. I can't remember. And by the end, I was just crying. I don't think I'd ever cried in front of my wife before. And I'm just dissolving into tears. She's like, you okay? I'm like, I don't know. It's just so beautiful. It's just so perfect.
I love it. I'm in Durham right now. I'm in Durham, North Carolina, in a hotel room. So I have to shout out Bull Durham, because I literally just drove by the Durham Bull Stadium, and that is my team. So I feel like it would not be right if I did not bring up that movie as well. But Brian Curtis, where can we find all your work? And we'll let you go enjoy your Friday.
Pressbox podcast every Monday and Thursday. Mondays with David Shoemaker, Thursday with a media eminence. This week, Isaac Chotiner of The New Yorker, and then TheRinger.com for written stuff.
I love it. Brian, you're the best. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We will be back on Tuesday with Cousin Sal and Kevin O'Connor, and we will see you then on Through the Ringer.